Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy, it won't be long. Healing rain is coming down, it's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name. The healing rain, it comes with fire, so let it fall and take us higher.
Good morning. Welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. So happy to be with you. Yesterday was Labor Day, the official end of summer, and actually the official beginning of fall isn't until September 21st, but we're moving right now into the fall season. So pack up your swimming trunks until next year, everyone. All the pools are closed. Well, it's so good to be with you today. I always love to do my program on the allotted time schedule of Monday and Thursday, but the curse of work had me yesterday, if you will, and I was working at the hospital, wasn't unable to do the program. But I'm here today, and just to let you know, coming up in just two days, a very special guest, Pastor Donald Fareed of Persian Ministries, will be here to talk about his ministry to Iranians. I will really look forward to that. And then again, on Monday, September 8th, we have a very special guest, Nadia Sharam. She is the author of a book, Marriage on the Streets of Tehran. It's a novel based on the temporary marriages that take place in Iran, and she's a human rights activist. She is going to talk about human rights for Muslim women. This is going to be a very, very interesting interview coming up on Monday, September 8th. And then the day that changed the world, Thursday, September 11th. Can you believe this? 13 years ago, we suffered an incredible attack from Islamic radicals, and all of our lives were changed forever. On that day, I have a very special guest, Letitia Wong. We're going to talk about the problem of suffering and evil and some things that relates to that subject. We're going to delve deeply into what's happening into our world with the onslaught of ISIS, the terror, the brutality, the suffering and death. We're going to get together, Letitia and me, and we're going to talk about this very important subject, because for most non-Christians, the subject of suffering and evil is a roadblock for many to come to faith in Christ. And we're going to try to unpack this difficult topic and try to bring some biblical insight into this problem of suffering and evil and why a good and all-powerful God allows that to happen in our world. So those are some upcoming programs on The Cross in the Desert. Well, we have been zeroing in on the onslaught of ISIS here on The Cross in the Desert for the past month at least, because it's such a relevant, important topic. And one of the most important things we need to take away from this subject is, what is our position as the United States? What should we be doing directly to help the suffering Iraqi Christians, the Yazidis, to secure these borders, to stop the onslaught of ISIS? What should be our position? Well, our president, just a few days ago, gave our position on what we should be doing and how we should be carrying the fight on into Syria to stop ISIS. I want you to hear these very troubling remarks from President Obama right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Well,
I have consulted with Congress throughout this process. I am confident that as Commander-in-Chief, I have the authorities to engage in the acts that we are conducting currently. As our strategy develops, we will continue to consult with Congress, and I do think that it'll be important for Congress to weigh in, and or that our consultations with Congress continue to develop so that the American people are part of the debate. But I don't want to put the cart before the horse. We don't have a strategy yet. I think what I've seen in some of the news reports suggests that folks are getting a little further ahead of where we're at than we currently are. And I think that's not just my assessment, but the assessment of our military as well. We need to make sure that we've got clear plans, that we're developing them. At that point, I will consult with Congress and make sure that their voices are heard. But there's no point in me asking for action on the part of Congress before I know exactly what it is that is going to be required for us to get the job done. All right?
Can you believe that our president, in this very brief response, said, basically, we have no strategy in the fight against ISIS going into Syria? And these remarks brought a hailstorm of controversy. So I want to go right now to Fox's Ed Henry on Obama's statement about no strategy. Let's listen.
Ed Henry. Ed.
Good evening, Megan. There's one word to describe what happened today, and that's disaster. I know that because I was sitting there, and I heard it with my own ears, and I was stunned. I didn't get called on, but I was stunned at my colleagues who were called on later after he said that, didn't follow up and just simply say, why is there no strategy? After a whole line of officials have said, this is a grave disaster. Chuck Hagel saying this is worse than Al-Qaeda pre-9/11. The second reason why I know it's a disaster is that ever since the president uttered it, the White House has been in damage control mode. I've gotten phone calls on Twitter. Josh Earnest was out there saying, here's what he was really saying. And then a press release just came out a couple moments ago about the president's meeting in the Situation Room, and the readout said that he discussed the, quote, comprehensive strategy to deal with ISIS. So they're now saying tonight the president spoke with his team about a comprehensive strategy he said a few hours ago he did not have. Now, the important context we should note is he was being asked about Syria. And earlier in this news conference, the president did say, in fact, he has a military strategy to deal with Iraq. And we've seen more than 100 U.S. airstrikes there. But he was being pressed about Syria and why haven't you gone to Congress? And frankly, he uttered something that was just honest. He said, I can't go to Congress and sell a plan I don't have yet. I don't have a strategy for Syria yet. So this is a problem. One final note I admit. Last night I reported that amid all this crisis, the president tomorrow is going to Rhode Island to fundraise. That caught your interest. I want to correct one thing. It's not just Rhode Island. We now learn he's going to Westchester, New York tomorrow to fundraise as well. So I was right, it's Rhode Island, but he's also going to be fundraising in New York. Two stops, fundraisers tomorrow after all of this, Megan.
Not to worry. Now they do have a comprehensive strategy. Not to worry. Ed, thank you.
Can you believe this? Do you remember when the American journalist James Foley was beheaded, the video, of course, all over the Internet, and President Obama made some remarks about it. Seconds after he made those remarks, he went back to golfing. Can you believe it? And also after these remarks about no strategy for Syria, he's planning to go fundraising. Does it occur to you and me that maybe our president is not vitally connected to the world scene, to what's happening to the many thousands and millions of people in Iraq, as this brutal Islamic militant terrorist group marches through? Oh, yes, our airstrikes have been effective, and yes, we've sent humanitarian aid, but we need to stop it at the root. We need to go into Syria, and we need to stop this group to where they originated from. This is amazing. As I sit here, I cannot believe that our president is not vitally connected to one of the most terrorist regimes in the world. And all of this in light of what? Today's the second? In 9 days from now, we're going to look back as a nation to the brutal terrorist attacks of 9/11. Don't you think that perhaps maybe ISIS is planning something for us on that day through other groups? Where is our president in the midst of all of this? Well, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel admits how serious the threat is. Let's listen right now on The Cross in the Desert.
ISIL is as sophisticated and well-funded as any group that we have seen. They're beyond just a terrorist group. They marry ideology, a sophistication of strategic and tactical military prowess. They are tremendously well-funded. Oh, this is beyond anything that we've seen. So we must prepare for everything when we look at what they did to Mr. Foley, what they threatened to do to all Americans and Europeans, what they are doing now. I don't know any other way to describe it other than barbaric. They have no standard of decency, of responsible human behavior, and I think the record's pretty clear on that. So, yes, they are an imminent threat to every interest we have, whether it's in Iraq or anywhere else. But we are working with international partners. We're working closely with Peshmerga and the ISF. We are doing everything we can within the confines of our influence to assist and recognize, as we've said, to deal with ISIL there in the Middle East, and also recognizing that it is a threat, just as we've all said.
Well, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has at least got a clue as to what's going on here, and he calls them ISIL, ISIS. The point being is that this administration has been dragging their heels on so many vital issues of security with our nation, and now with one of the most extreme, brutal terroristic groups making their way through Iraq and other areas, we should be directly engaging them. And, of course, the reason why our president is meek and mild about this is he doesn't want to commit to troops again in Iraq. He worked hard to remove them. That was his claim of the presidency, that I will remove our influence in Iraq. I will bring our troops home. Well, we are facing a threat, a direct threat with our borders not being secure. ISIS, have they crossed our borders? We're going to find out in a few minutes. But right now, I want to take you to a conversation just recently here on the Fox News Network with Sean Hannity and Mark Levin as they described this situation in a program called The Rise of Radical Islam. Let's listen.
Welcome back to the special edition of Hannity, The Rise of Radical Islam. Now, for years, conservative talk radio hosts, including myself, we have been warning the Obama administration about the danger posed by Islamic extremists, but it appears our commander-in-chief was, well, too preoccupied with his golf game to care. Now, I recently sat down with one of the administration's most vocal critics. He's the great one. We call him Mark Levin. Listen in. Mark, ISIS has acquired more land, they have more money, they have more firepower, they are more brutal, evil, and ruthless than even Al-Qaeda, if you can imagine. They said to the United States, we will see you in New York. We saw what they did to this photojournalist. They said they'll want to raise the flag of Islam in our White House. What do you make of the president's reaction or lack thereof? It seems to me that this is a situation where people have declared war against us.
You know, I want the American people to understand something, Sean. The commander-in-chief, and we only have one, is the president of the United States, and his name is Barack Obama. And these cockroaches organized, funded themselves, built a forceful military, started conquering geographic areas all around the world under his nose. He ignored it. He did nothing about it. He didn't talk to the American people about it. As a matter of fact, he downplayed it. This is one of the worst military national security screw-ups in modern American history, and he's still screwing up. Has he rallied the American people? Has he spoken to Congress? Has he asked for a declaration of war or at least a joint resolution to fund an aggressive, offensive attack against these cockroaches? No, he hasn't. We're dealing with a very peculiar, petulant man who operates with a few advisors around him, a man who really needs as much counseling and expertise as he can get, given his very thin resume and experience record. And this is what's going on. And I'm going to tell you something else, because you've brought up a number of issues here. If this president thinks that by changing the word treaty to accord or treaty to deal, that he can violate Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2 of the United States Constitution, which involves the essential rights of the Union. That's what Governor Morris, delegate to the Constitutional Convention, said on September 8, 1787. This treaty process involves essential rights of the Union. Then this is number 1,200 example of a lawless imperial president. This treaty...
Those are essentially important remarks from Mark Levin with Sean Hannity, that our president is twisting the Constitution for his own gain, and he should be directly involved with this serious military threat because it affects the security of not only the Middle East and our allies, it also affects the security of our embassies there and other areas, and we can go back to what happened in Benghazi because of our lack of real support and security, and this is a very serious situation. Now, one of the issues dealing with ISIS, and one of the questions many of us have on our mind, are they involved in trying to undermine our security by crossing over our borders? Have they crossed over our borders? Well, let's listen right now to an answer to that question right now on the Cross in the Desert.
Wow. Joshua Katz is a former policy advisor to the House Homeland Security Committee, and he joins us now. Joshua, nice to see you this morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
What do you make of these reports of ISIS collaborating with Mexican drug cartels to exploit our southern border?
Yeah, I think that Governor Perry's words are unfortunately very, very true. We have seen this administration and the lack of security, a lack of policy along the U.S. border. But I think more importantly, they have really shown, this administration has really shown a lack of understanding. They've absolutely underestimated the threat from ISIS. And almost now a year ago, I was advising senior members of Congress on the threat from ISIS. So this is something that the that has been known to all of us for a while.
Where are we pulling this information from, Joshua? I'm curious because, as you point out and others, that their cartels have been collaborating with, their reports collaborating with Al-Qaeda going back years. So are we hearing chatter? Can Americans rest easy somehow this morning that the FBI is watching these individuals?
I think that the problem here is manyfold, unfortunately. First of all, ISIS is a group that will do whatever it takes in order to accomplish its goals. It's very brutal. It's very aggressive. They're going to do anything. And if that means working with cartels, if that means working with other illicit groups in order to attack the homeland, they will do. Other groups like Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups who have a desire to hit the homeland will also use that. However, the one particular sort of a difference here with ISIS is that we have Americans that have left America and are now working, training, fighting with ISIS, both in Syria and Iraq, as well as, you know, the numbers are vary, but possibly over 2,000 Europeans. And those Europeans also can pose a threat to the homeland. So we have this sort of... this double front aggression towards America's borders, which is why this administration really needs to continue, needs to start, rather, to push the borders out and to take this fight to ISIS and to where these terrorists live.
Absolutely frightening, especially when we saw that iPhone video in front of the White House last week or a few weeks ago. That was even more frightening. Joshua Katz,
absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
The bottom line is we have to take seriously their boasts, their threats. You may say, well, they'll never really attack us like that. That's just a Middle Eastern thing. But as rightly pointed out, they will work with the drug cartels to attack us that way. And they said that we're going to raise the flag of Allah at the White House, and we can laugh and say, oh, that's never going to happen. We need to take this seriously. We need to fight them right where they're at. We need to put an end to their military might right where they're at in Syria. Well, what I want to do right now on the Cross in the Desert is turn our attention to a topic that we've been talking about here for a very long time, and that is the plight of Saeed Abedini, who's languishing in prison in Iran. And our president, while he did last year say to President Rouhani, release him, he has not been very active since then. And we have Americans abroad in Iranian prison that need to come home. Amir Hikmati, Saeed Abedini, Kenneth Bey in North Korea, they need to come home. Our president needs to be vigilant and address this situation. Well, just recently, Negma Abedini, Saeed's wife, was on the Steve Malzberg show for a very intimate interview, and I want to play that for you right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
Dear President Obama, please help bring my daddy home. I miss him so much. I want my daddy to bring me to Disneyland for my birthday.
How do you know it's crying?
Because I feel it.
Oh. Your heart is crying?
Yeah.
Oh.
I pray that he'll come back home, but he's still not back home.
Hi, folks. I don't know how you keep your eyes dry after watching that. Those are the children of that's Rebecca and Jacob Abedini pleading with President Obama to bring their father home from Iran. We have talked to Negma Abedini, the wife of Pastor Saeed Abedini, many times on this show. She joins us once again. Negma, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Having me back.
Well, before we get to your kids and the making of that video and why you decided to take that route, what is the latest? When's the last time you talked to your husband or heard from your husband, and what do you know?
Well, I'm not allowed to talk to him, but his parents visit him in prison every Wednesday, so about a week ago is what I heard. He's doing better, but he's still struggling with internal bleeding because of the beatings in the hands of the hardliners, the radicals there in the with the prison system. And he's in the worst prison. He's in one of the worst prisons in the world. He was in Evin. Now he's in an exile prison, which is even worse. And we just need to get him home.
Second year of an 8-year sentence, and the crime is being Christian.
That's it. And, actually, what a lot of people don't realize is that the Iranian government has said he hasn't even committed a crime. They approved our conversion in 2004 when there was a different president, Khatami. And so legally they've said they've recognized our conversion, our marriage. We married in Iran. We had a Christian wedding. They said, his crime is undermining the national security of Iran. They said home gatherings of Christians was the cause of that, which happened in the earlier years of 2000. And in Iran, gatherings of Christians, of religious minorities, is not a crime. But they said, well, when the Christians gather, they're really trying to undermine our government. So really, if you read into their conviction of 8 years, they haven't said Saeed has committed any crimes or has broken any law.
You and I always ask you, what do you tell your kids? How are they handling it? And they're getting older, as we've seen in that that video. And when your daughter asks, why does her daddy need to be in prison for loving Jesus? First of all, what made you go the route of releasing or making and releasing this video?
The kids have been hidden for the last 2 years. And as we've talked about, I say, they're hurting. But I felt, first of all, as the years are going by, it's getting harder for them. My daughter was 5. Now she's almost 8. She's missed 3 birthdays without him. And that's a lot of years for an 8-year-old, 3 years out of her 8 years and 3 birthdays. And so it's just, it's getting harder. They're crying a lot. They're asking for him a lot. First days of school and so on. And I really felt that the world needed to get a glimpse. I have a lot of videos, unfortunately, of them crying and asking for him. But I just shared a few seconds of each for the world to see when I say my kids are hurting, they're suffering. And just because my husband's a Christian, he hasn't broken any law, and Iran's holding him illegally. They're torturing him. And I just want the world to see these are kids that are hurting. This is a family. This is just not the news. This is more than the news. It's a family in pain every single day.
Nagma, they are just beautiful, beautiful children, and so brave and going through so much. Do you hope that Obama see what do you hope to accomplish, and what would you say to Obama as well?
You know, I hope he sees the human part of it. You know, as a dad, he can get desperate and what can I do? What phone call can I make to bring this dad home? He's away from his kids and his kids. So with my two daughters hurting like this every single night, every single day, what would I do? And I hope to reach his human part of the his human side. You know, we're at the best place we've ever been with Iran, where they're wanting help with ISIS. They're, you know, we're negotiating. This is an easy ask. He hasn't broken any law. He's not in the, you know, Iran hasn't said he was a spy or he's broken any of their internal laws. We're sitting across the table. We're still negotiating. We're releasing billions and billions of dollars, and this is a perfect time to get him home. And I hope he sees the human side of this, that, you know, he's a dad, he has two daughters, he has two kids, and I hope it reaches, you know, something inside of him to want to do something to get him home tomorrow, today.
Does that make it all the more difficult knowing, you know, here's the thing, we're enemies with Iran, but he's reached out to them, he's had private talks with them, as you correctly indicated, we're negotiating them over a nuclear program, we're on the philosophically on the same side against ISIS, you know, so here's an opportunity, but yet I haven't heard the words cross the name of your husband cross his lips. And in Mexico, I mean, what if we were friends with Iran? Would it be any better? Because look at Mexico. Look at Sergeant Tamarisi, who made a wrong turn, and he's rotting in prison, going back and forth to court. Not in the situation your husband's in, but nonetheless, he's a Marine and he's in jail there. And Obama doesn't say his name. So you think it would be different if we were friendlier with Iran, or you think it wouldn't make a difference?
You know, it's frustrating because we are friendlier. You know, when first sight was taken, I was told that, well, we're not talking to Iran, you know, and so there's not much we can do. Now we are talking to them. So it's frustrating because now we are in better terms with Iran. They got, you know, a $5 billion, and then recently another $2 billion released, helping with their economy and so on. So it's frustrating because we are in better terms with Iran, and this should be an easy ask. You know,
I don't want to interrupt. We have 30 seconds left. What could the folks do to help you?
You know, continue to put pressures on your senators, congressmen, call the State Department. Every voice counts. It does. It makes a difference.
All right.
And election time is coming up, so
I appreciate it. And the switchboard in Washington, D.C., congressional switchboard, is 202-224-3121, folks. 202-224-3121 or 202-225-3121. You could get any senator, any congressman, and you could ask them for the State Department number there as well. Nagma, thank you so much, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
All right, my pleasure. All right, folks, what could I say? What a horrific, horrific situation. Those kids are adorable. We'll be back with more of the show, but stay tuned for your Newsmax Now update.
September 26, 2014 marks 2 years since my husband, Pastor Saeed, has been in prison in Iran. I'm doing a prayer vigil on this day to remember Pastor Saeed and others who are in prison for Christ, but also as a chance to come together as the body of Christ and see the move of God as we pray together. Please join me on this special day as we come together and pray.
Well, and that is Nagma Abedini talking about the upcoming prayer vigil today, September 2nd, 24 days, a little more than 3 weeks for this worldwide prayer vigil with more than 300-plus cities that have already signed up. You may say, well, is there still time for me? Yes, there are. Yes, there is. And how do I get in contact with Nagma? Well, let's do this really quickly. I want you to get a piece of paper and a pen, or if you're at your keyboard, type this down. This is her email address if you want to get involved in the prayer vigil. Global Vigil, GLOBALVIGIL, Global Vigil 2014 at gmail.com. That's Global Vigil 2014 at gmail.com. BeHeardProject.com. Also, what you can do is go to the BeHeardProject.com, scroll down that page, and there's also instructions about this prayer vigil. This is a pivotal event, because while we look to our government to try to make a difference in Saeed's situation, and that is something we should do, to look and to cry out to our government, there is nothing that is more important than crying out to our great God and Savior in prayer. Last year, during the vigil, many, many incredible things happened. One of the things that happened was just a few days before the vigil, when Nagma was in New York, she ran into the entourage for Rouhani at a hotel and was able to directly walk up to the entourage and to hand one of the security guards a personal letter from her husband crying out to the president of Iran. So this happened prior to the vigil. An amazing event happened. And so I know that our God hears and answers our prayers. And while we might not understand the reason for delay sometimes we look at our efforts and say, well, God, did you hear our prayers? Why aren't you answering? There's always a reason. There's always a reason why it doesn't happen right away. The scriptures are very replete with promises that prayer is powerful, that it's something that God has ordained that we do when we cry out to him. And I was thinking about this when I thought about Negma, because she has taught me so much in regard to prayer and faithfulness. One of the things she talks about is embracing your trials and how we should look at trials. And she certainly is an amazing example of how to manage under trials. What she has gone through, there is so much she can teach all of us as Christians. I look at James chapter 5, and the scripture that comes to my mind is really important about prayer. It says, the earnest prayer of a righteous person has great power and produces wonderful results. And then the example James gives is Elijah was as human as we are, and yet when he prayed earnestly that no rain would fall, none fell for 3.5 years. Then when he prayed again, the sky sent down rain and the earth began to yield its crops. Well, listen again to the promise of just one person. The earnest prayer, singular, of a righteous person has great power and produces wonderful results. Well, if you think of the example that James gives of just one person, what about thousands and millions united for a single purpose, crying out to our great God to move into this situation, that he would touch the heart of the Iranian regime to release Saeed? Well, I have a very special guest that has just come on my call switchboard, and her name is Teresa, and she's going to join us right now on the Cross in the Desert, and we're going to talk about last year's prayer vigil. I want to welcome you, Teresa, to the Cross in the Desert. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you, Randy. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, just
you wanted
prior,
to hear
I don't know
about,
if you...
You
yeah,
wanted to hear about the vigil?
Right, but before you talk about that, I don't know if you had a chance just a few minutes ago to hear the special interview I had with Negma talking with Steve Malzberg about the latest events with Saeed. She was on there. I don't know if you had a chance to hear that. Yes,
yes,
we're going to talk
did.
About – yeah, isn't she amazing the way that she's able to be so strong, just grace under pressure?
I'm overwhelmed. When I hear her speak, she is just amazing. What she has gone through and how far she has come, her testimony is so amazing. It is such an inspiration to me.
Yeah, when I had Negma on the Cross in the Desert about a year ago, one of the things that struck me, Teresa, that she says is what she has learned through this horrible trial is that instead of running from our trials, she said we ought to embrace our trials. And yet,
exactly,
Teresa,
yeah.
Don't many of us want to run away from those events and not be, you know, emotionally attached to those? We don't want to embrace trials, but Negma is saying we need to do that.
Right, and try to be healed and be used even though we are going through a trial.
Well, Tell our audience today how it is you got to know Nigma. Tell us a little bit about your friendship with her, and then we're going to talk about the prayer vigil you had last year.
Actually, just yesterday I was looking through my messages on Facebook that I had with Nigma ever since I got to know her. Our friendship started in the early spring in 2013, shortly after I started praying for her and Saeed. And I just heard that she was on Facebook. I wanted to know her. I wanted to get to know her more. I wanted to share with her my prayers for her. And when I sent the request for friendship, it was accepted right away, and I was just overwhelmed and so thankful. I started to pay really close attention to the news, and whenever I was able to hear her speak on Fox News or other programs, I would listen and read the things that I heard her say, news articles and such. Then when I heard that she was going to do the prayer vigil last year, I wanted to be partake in it. And so I sent her a message asking her if there was going to be one near me. And she told me no. And, oh, my goodness, I was really sad, and I didn't really know what to do about it.
Well, it sounds like to me the way you described that is that you thought, okay, there's no vigil near me, so that means that I have to have one, right?
That was the thought that just wouldn't get out of my mind. I couldn't get away from that thought. So that became my prayer, and I got the okay from my husband to go ahead with that and told Nigma that I wanted to do that, but I was totally scared, and because I don't do that kind of thing.
Right,
I don't,
this is something not natural for you, right?
No, not at all. And so when I told her that, she said, well, I don't do it either,
yeah.
But we're going to do it together. And
right.
I was just so overwhelmed by her just sharing her heart like that and being so kind and helpful. She started sending me emails to help me know what to do. The first thing I did was talk to the mayor about a location, and we decided
right.
on a place, and it turned out to be a really good location. And let's see, the other things that we needed to do, we needed to get the flyers printed out.
Right.
And mailed, sent emails to different places, to government people, to try to raise awareness. I contacted
right.
the radio station, press release, stuff like that. And
well, in fact, the location you chose was an outdoor location. Is that true? You had this is not just indoors. This was an outdoor location you chose.
Yeah, it was outdoors, and it turned out to be such a gorgeous, beautiful day.
Right.
And we had about six people lined up to pray, and probably about 70 people attended. Some people drove 2 hours to come.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you imagine that there would be that much response?
No. No, a lot of these people who came, I didn't know were going to be there.
That's amazing.
So I was so blessed and just felt my strength to do it increased and was able to introduce the speakers. And my son-in-law had come to share the song Overcome, which was Saeed's favorite song.
Yes, it is.
And do you want me to share what happened?
Tell us what happened during the prayer vigil, because this is something you were a little bit apprehensive to do, but the Lord provided you with many opportunities to call radio stations and churches, mm-hmm. and many more people showed up than you imagined, and then something kind of amazing happened when the song Overcome by Jeremy Camp was being performed there. What happened?
Right. We were sitting there and singing the song, and the clouds and the sunshine were just so bright and beautiful, and eagles started coming out from the clouds and circling over the group. There were seven eagles, and they circled over our group of prayer during the song. And after the song, people came up and were just saying, "Did you see that? Wasn't that just amazing how that gave them chills and shivers?" And it was just such a confirmation that God was hearing the prayers that were going up all over the world for Saeed and for the persecuted church. It was nothing that I can even describe. It was so beautiful. And I made new friends, and I just am so thankful. And I shared that with Nagme, and she was blessed, and wonderful things like that happened with the other vigils too. I'm hoping there is going to be an amazing book someday with all the testimonies.
In fact, you have a testimony. You went to a particular, I think it's the Facebook link. It's Voices of the Persecuted, mm-hmm. I believe. And there is a place there where they're asking people like yourself to write down how Saeed's situation has affected your spiritual walk with the Lord. And what they're going to do is collect all of these testimonies, have it printed in a book, and present it to Saeed when one day he is freed. Isn't that right?
That's right. I just needed to do that. When I saw that there was an opportunity to do that, my heart just poured out. The words just came and flowed, and because it has become such a part of me to pray for them, I looked over my messages to and from Nagme over the past year and a half, and I can see how personal it is for me during my times of prayer, that I will hear little messages from the Lord or see like a picture in my mind and share those with her. And I know that it touches her heart. It really is a comfort to her to do those kind of things. She doesn't think weird about people when they share things like that. Some people might think, mm-hmm. "Oh, that's weird. You know, you shouldn't talk like that. God's not that personal." But God is personal.
Yeah. Oh yes, yes.
I want
to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wait, I want to ask you a question before you share some more. There's probably some people struggling with mm-hmm. wanting to do this, and we're just 3.5 weeks away from the next vigil. But you faced your fears, and you went ahead and did this anyway. What can you tell those folks that may be listening that are struggling to have one? How would you encourage them based on what you did?
I think that don't be afraid, because God is in this work. And one thing that happened, about a month ago, I was starting to feel discouraged because I hadn't been hearing from people yet telling me they were coming. And mm-hmm. almost exactly when I started having those doubts and insecurities, I got an email from Nagme, and she said, don't be thinking about numbers. God is in this. He'll bring who he wants to be here.
Right.
And just hearing that and the timing of it just helps me to know that God is in it. And people shouldn't be afraid. You don't need to worry about numbers. You don't need to worry about the details of planning mm-hmm. the vigil. You do what you can. If you can't mm-hmm. get the flyers printed out, you just spread the word by mouth. Just tell people and mm-hmm. have a vigil even at your church.
Well, and you know, there has been a sudden. Didn't mean to interrupt you there.
Okay.
I wanted to mention there is almost 400 cities responding already and are going to host the vigil. And not only that, last year there was actually prayer vigils in Israel and some in Russia. And this year they actually had Save Saeed yellow T-shirts at the World Cup games in Brazil. So this prayer vigil, Teresa, has taken off. From a small seed, it has grown like a huge canopy over the world. Can you believe that?
Right. I know. I had a newspaper interview last week, and the person said, "How is that? Why do you think that it has grown so much?" And mainly what I think is that Nagme is being the warrior princess for Saeed. She is going and being a voice for her husband in the most amazing way. And when you hear her testimony that she was so shy and insecure, would avoid public speaking, and had so many doubts about her own self and her own faith, and you see how far she has come, how she has stepped out of her comfort zone, and out there speaking to thousands and thousands of people. And if I can do this little bit, it is just so small compared to what she's doing. But I'm just so thankful to have the opportunity to serve.
As you look back at where you've come from to now with the prayer vigil, how has this changed your life, your walk with the Lord, your confidence, your faith? What has this done for you personally?
I'm a different person. Totally, absolutely different.
Wow.
I still have my fears and insecurities.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look back and to see the changes and see how I'm able to hear God's voice again after I went through some period of difficulty, just going through my own struggles and heartaches, depression, personal stuff. This has been something that has given me something to focus on outside of my own self, to pray for other people.
Well, I like the way that you described it, because when I'm thinking about what you say, the problems that all of us have, Teresa, it shows me the greatness of our God, how he uses ordinary people like you and me that struggle with many problems to accomplish his purpose. That he blesses and uses us. You mentioned Nagma. She was not a public speaker. She admits that. And because of this situation, God has used her mightily to speak the word. She's gone to Voice of Persian Radio to speak the word. And she's spoken the gospel, proclaimed the gospel in Farsi to her own people in Iran, where she used to live. She's had opportunities to go to Liberty University during convocation to speak for Saeed. She's gone to the United Nations in Geneva.
Yeah.
So you mentioned how it's changed your life, and we see how it's changed Nagma's life. So we know that God is involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
I think where we all struggle, Teresa, is that why is it taking so long to bring Saeed back to his children? They recently made a video, Rebecca and Jacob, pleading with President Obama to bring their daddy home. It's so hard for them. It's so difficult for these children who have grown up without their father in the last 2 years.
Right. It just is heartbreaking. And I just hope that Obama, when he hears that and sees that, that it pierces his heart, too. And
he's a father.
It should compel him. My goodness, when I think about that woman, Miriam, who was in Sudan in the prison, and Italy went in and got her out of there. I just think there's absolutely no reason why Obama can't do something to get Saeed out.
And just this morning before the program, I heard about the North Korean dictator, as you know who he is. He is willing to sit down and negotiate for the freedom of Kenneth Bay. So what we need to do, Teresa, is to engage Iran. Instead of talking about nuclear rights, we need to talk about human rights and
right.
bring our Americans home. I wanted to spend the last few minutes with you talking about something amazing that's happened in your life. You said how the prayer visual has changed you. Well, also, the Lord has been so gracious to you in this last year and to start molding and shaping you for a ministry I don't think you were willing or even ready to do, but you have a unique ministry that you go and do public speakings at women's conferences, and it's called Broken to Beautiful. And share with us what that's all about and how it can change the lives of Christians.
Okay, I've actually only been able to do this a couple of times, but I'm hoping to be able to do it many more times. It is basically a weaving of a lot of different pictures, stories, Bible passages that God has brought that they're like a mosaic is the way I can describe it. That illustrate broken to beauty. And part of that is my testimony of being broken and being willing for God to mend me and how he uses all the broken pieces of our lives. Like I kind of describe it as the floor is scattered with broken pieces. All different colors and textures from all of our different lives, and he scoops them all up in his hands, and when he picks them up in his hands, they make his hands bleed. They hurt him. Our hurt hurts him. And I came across an image of a kind of pottery in Japan where they take broken pottery and mend it together with gold. It's called kintsukuri. It is such an absolutely beautiful picture of what Jesus does with our lives, how he mends us with gold, and then that gold becomes the glorious beauty, the focal point of the vessel. The place where the broken was is just like magnified and glorious with the way that he has brought healing. And so when I share, it's a combination of the different images that he showed me and Bible verses, and I also pray with people during the teaching and afterwards, praying for them to be able to accept their hurts and give them to God and come to a place of healing and willingness for him to use them in even though they are hurting.
Well, what are some of the biblical examples of showing this concept of going from broken to beautiful and how God, the master potter, takes our broken pieces of our lives and molds them back together? Is there any one example in the Bible that stands out as a good illustration of this?
One of the main ones that I've used is where the woman brings the alabaster box to Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
I studied about alabaster, and just is such an amazing material and how it's easily damaged and breaks so easy. And when she brought it to Jesus and broke it, the perfume just spilled into the air, just the scent filled the air in every crack and crevice so that what she was doing couldn't be hidden. And she did it in spite of all the accusations and shouts and from the people around. And Jesus just loved on her, basically. He loved on her and blessed her and was thankful for what she did. And he made sure that she was remembered even today.
Yes, and that's important that we point out the context of that, the reason that she did that. She was preparing him for his burial, mm-hmm. for his upcoming crucifixion. But, of course, we had the religious leaders all surrounding Jesus to try to say, mm-hmm. you know, why are you allowing this sinner to come into your presence, to come into this home?
Right. And how we shouldn't walk away from sinners. We should be willing to pray for them in it. You know,
yes.
not to love their sin, but to love the person.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. That's a good illustration. I like that, the alabaster box. It's only in our brokenness that we can be healed. But, Teresa, don't you think a lot of Christians try to hide their hurts with other Christians? They don't want to talk about their hurts. And
we put on a mask.
It's only when we allow ourselves to be broken before the Lord that we can experience healing.
I'm a good example.
Oh, really?
Absolutely.
Well, I think that's a wonderful ministry you had. Mm-hmm. I like the point that you show the visuals of the broken pots, the broken pieces. There are so many lives that are hurting and broken, and you know, on my program, I talk to many people.
Right.
And some of the people that hear my program are Iranians. And you know about what I do with Iranians to try to bring them hope and freedom and through standing up for their human rights, but most importantly, bringing them hope and freedom by sharing with them the good news of Christ.
Right.
Tell us in a few words, talk to that person that may be listening, Teresa, that their life is broken. Can they expect? What kind of hope can they get from coming to Christ?
Amazing things can happen in your life when you embrace your brokenness and tell Yeshua, tell Jesus that you want him to heal and use you, and how you can reach out to others who are hurting too. He can heal you with your from your brokenness and give you a focus in the light that he has, the light of Jesus. He's the light of the world, and all the healing and beautiful things in the world come from him, and he definitely can make something beautiful out of broken.
Amen, amen. Well, Teresa, tell us now, I want to go from this ministry that you've been mm-hmm. involved with, and I'm really happy to hear. I'm excited how it's going to make a change in many broken lives. Now tell us, this year, I'm going to go back to the visual.
Okay.
Where is it going to be held at? What time is it going to be? Talk to some people about it, and where is it going to be?
The one that we're doing here, it's at a place along the river. It's in a park, and it's called the Riverfront Freedom Memorial. And we're doing it at noon. We thought that the location was absolutely perfect because it's more quiet. The place last year was wonderful and right for last year, but this is different. It's not where there's a lot of traffic. And the fact that it's called Freedom Memorial, it's just a really good place.
And what city is this going to be in?
This is in East Peoria, Illinois.
Okay. So
it's
I like that
Walmart.
You're going to have it.
Go ahead.
It's next to a river. It's called Freedom Park?
Yes.
Wow.
Or Riverfront Park, I think is what it's called. Freedom.
Oh.
Riverfront Freedom Memorial is where it is in the park. It's a certain little place where there's flags.
Okay, now if someone wants to join this vigil, you said some people last year drove 2 hours away to come to it. How do they get in contact with you?
They can look on the website, on the vigil website to find the address for it, or my email address.
Okay.
Do you want my email address from
there? Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
It's my name, Teresa Bodkin, at mtco.com.
Okay. Okay. Great. Great. Well, I've really enjoyed listening to your testimony and how God is using this ministry and how he's molded and shaped your life with this prayer vigil. I want to add to what Teresa says. If anyone wants to get involved in this prayer vigil, it's September 26th. September 26th is on a Tuesday. Oh, no, I got the wrong calendar. I got to change my calendar. Forget that one. I have to change it. You know, it's on a Friday. It's on a Friday, September 26th. I was still in August. What's wrong with me?
Oops.
It's Friday, September 26th. And what is the time of the vigil this year? What time are we focusing
well,
on?
The one that we're having is at noon, but different places are having it at different times.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you, Rand, do you happen to know where Nagme is going to be? Is she going to be in her hometown, Boise, or is she going to be in Washington?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I wish I did. I'll have to get some more information. But I wanted to give our listeners the email address to get involved with the vigil. You can contact NAGMA at globalvigil2014@gmail.com or also go to the beheardproject.com and you can find out more details. I really am so glad that you are doing this, Teresa, this year. I'm so glad that your life has been changed. I know you're looking forward to this and to your many radio interviews about your ministry, Broken to Beautiful. It's been such a pleasure having you on, and please, you'll have to come on again after the vigil and tell us what happened. You'll have to let our listeners know how the Lord worked in your vigil. Will you do that?
Yes, I will. Thank you, Randy.
Okay, well, thank you, Teresa. God bless you, and have a wonderful day. Thank you for coming on The Cross in the Desert. That's my good friend Teresa about the prayer vigil and her ministry, Broken to Beautiful. So glad that she was able to come on and share with us because, you know, I know her. She's been a friend for many, many years, and she doesn't do a lot of these things, but the Lord is really working in her life, and she is doing some amazing things, standing up for what she believes and going out in faith and doing things she never used to do before. I'm so thankful that she is bold. She's like a lioness, and she's coming out of that closet, and she's doing things amazing that she never did before. I want to take you to a song right now with just a half an hour left in our broadcast today. This is a song that has truly shaped my life. It's a very personal song about the love of Christ, that he will never leave or forsake us. This is a band that did an amazing job in this song. It's called He Won't Let You Go. Here's the cry right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen. That is the music of the cry and the cross in the desert, a song that illustrates the assurance we can have. And Jesus says, I will never leave you nor forsake you. He won't let you go. I have a rather lengthy interview here I want to have brought to you from a lady known as Waffle Sultan, who wrote a book called A God Who Hates. But before I go to this interview, which is from 4 years ago on the 700 Club with Pat Robertson, and I think it's very apropos since in the first half of the program I talked to you about ISIS and what's going on in the Middle East, of course, you know that. I want to tell you a little bit about Waffle Sultan, just to give you some background on who she is. She was born June 14, 1958 in Syria, and it's a medical doctor who trained as a psychiatrist there. She, of course, immigrated to the United States, and she's a critic of Muslim society and Islam. She's always wanted to be a writer, but she preferred to study Arabic literature, and she was studying at the University of Aleppo. She says that she was shocked into secularism and by the 1979 atrocities committed by Islamic extremists of the Muslim Brotherhood against innocent Syrians. She states that while she was a medical student, she witnessed the machine gun assassination of her professor, who was Yusuf al-Yusuf. And they shot hundreds of bullets into him, shouting, Allahu Akbar. Waffa says, at that point, I lost my trust in their God and began to question all of our teachings. It was the turning point of my life, and it has led me to the present point. I had to leave. I had to look, Waffa said, for another God. Now, she worked 4 more years as a psychiatrist in a hospital. Her and her husband and children immigrated to the United States in 1989. They moved to Los Angeles, California, and became naturalized citizens. And initially, as she came to California, she had to look for work, so she became a cashier in a gas station and behind the counter in a pizza parlor. But she found her treatment in these jobs better, she says, than the medical profession in Syria. From the time of her arrival, she began to contribute articles to Arabic publications in the United States and published 3 books in Arabic. And right after the atrocities of September 11, 2001, she began to write. And this is the reason why she wrote the book, A God Who Hates. So what I want to do now is let you hear Pat Robertson interview Waffa Sultan. And she will tell you about her reasons for writing this book, why it's titled A God Who Hates. We're going to hear all about it right now on the cross in the desert.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I had the privilege yesterday of reading in its entirety a book by Waffa Sultan called A God Who Hates. She was listed, I believe, by Newsweek as one of the 100 most influential people in the world because she stood up to a man on Al Jazeera and told him to be quiet so she could talk. And that just wasn't done in the Muslim world. But Sharia law is slowly working its way into public life in Islamic and non-Islamic aid nations around the world. But few people understand what Sharia law really is and what it means for the people who live under it. Gary Lane explains.
What is Sharia law?
Sharia law is the legal system based on the teachings of the Quran, the Sunnah, and the Hadith of Muhammad, being applied into the community as the legal basis for life.
Jeff Hammond is a Christian who has lived and worked in Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim nation, for 35 years. He says Indonesian Christians are concerned about creeping Sharia law, now in place in half of the country's 32 provinces.
It's going from one province to another. It's not something that's happening all at once, but step by step.
For example, even Christian schoolgirls are forced to cover their heads in Padang province. Elsewhere in Indonesia, children attending public schools are required to learn the Quran. In Indonesia's Aceh province, Sharia police make nightly patrols to ensure that unmarried or non-related couples are not seen together in public.
The Christians are very concerned, not only because of what's happened here in Indonesia, but they also see reports that have come in from other countries.
Islamic nations where devotion to Sharia law causes vigilantes in Somalia to behead a 25-year-old aid worker for converting from Islam to Christianity. In Iran, where women are legally stoned to death for committing adultery. in Afghanistan, where prostitutes like these two women are executed for their behavior. In Pakistan, the government apparently has accepted the imposition of Sharia law in the Taliban-controlled Swat Valley of the Northwest Frontier Province. It's a place where violators of Sharia are often subjected to lashes. Enforcement of Pakistan's blasphemy laws have led to the imprisonment of Christians like 20-year-old Sandal Bibi and her father, Golshir, on charges of blasphemy against the Quran. Syrian-born American psychiatrist Wafa Sultan is the author of the new book, A God Who Hates. She argues Islam is currently at war with itself. She says its treatment of women is the genesis of all modern-day Muslim intolerance. Islam's progression of violence, self-pity, and hate, says Sultan, will ultimately lead to the demise of the Muslim world.
Well, Wafa Sultan joins us now from Washington. Doctor, we welcome you to this program. Thank you for the book, A God Who Hates. Very interesting.
Thank you so much for having me.
You were raised in Syria. How are women treated under Islam?
Under Islam, women have no rights. They are terribly mistreated. They are considered to be mentally unfit to take care of themselves. A woman under Islamic Sharia has no right to choose her husband, has no right to ask for divorce, has no right to gain custody of her children. Her husband had the right to divorce her without a question asked, had the right to sleep with as many women as he can buy without any consideration for her dignity or her feelings. So generally speaking, women under Islam are isolated from the rest of the world. And I would love to give you an example from my own life. I dedicated my book to the memory of my niece. My niece was forced to marry her cousin. She was 11, he was over 40. Her life with him was very terrible life. He was very abusive. I always remember her escaping from her husband's home to her father, begging her father, you know, please let me stay here. I cannot take the torture anymore. He's very abusive. And her father would say, it is shame for a Muslim woman to leave her husband's house without his permission. So go back, and I promise I will talk to him. At the age of 28, my niece committed suicide, leaving four children behind her.
Let me ask you something. You pointed out, and I won't have to interrupt you, but because there's so much else to take in this book, you pointed out that Islam is living in essentially a 7th century world, that they're way backward and that they're losing out in science and medicine and all these other things because of adherence to Islam. Would you tell us about that?
You know, in the Islamic world, we are dealing with the mentality of the 7th century. So it is very hard. We are in totally different time and in totally different planet.
Well, let me ask you this. President Obama last night said, well, he said the terrorists or whatever term you want to give them, they've hijacked a great religion and changed it. Is that true?
It is a misconception
right.
that I need to clarify.
All right.
I believe Muslims are victims of their own belief system. Muslims are hijacked by their doctrine, not the other way around.
Well,
we are victims of our Islamic...
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I had the privilege yesterday of reading in its entirety a book by Wafa Sultan called A God Who Hates. She was listed, I believe, by Newsweek as one of the 100 most influential people in the world because she stood up to a man on Al Jazeera and told him to be quiet so she could talk. And that just wasn't done in the Muslim world. But Sharia law is slowly working its way into public life in Islamic and non-Islamic aid nations around the world. But few people understand what Sharia law really is and what it means for the people who live under it. Gary Lane explains.
And just giving you a little bit of an understanding of the book A God Who Hates by Wafa Sultan. And she is trying to point out there at the end when our interview ended is that Muslims are trapped in Islam, that it isn't a matter that terrorists have hijacked Islam and given it a bad name. She doesn't seem to make a distinction between moderate and radical Islam. She's simply saying it's all one and the same, and that even though there are many, many peaceful Muslims, I know because I have friends who are Muslims, but she's trying to say it's the teachings of Islam. It's not a matter of between moderate or radical. It's the actual teachings of Islam that perpetuate the violence in the world. And so there you heard it, a little bit of her understanding, her testimony. And I like the fact that she pointed out from the very beginning about that there are no rights for women in Islam. And one of the examples I give all the time when I talk about this issue is that what the Quran itself actually teaches in a specific situation. And here's what I want to say. Many, many peaceful Muslims will say, well, you know, we are not a violent religion, and it's misunderstood that men and women aren't equal in Islam. Actually, men and women are equal in Islam, and there are rights that women have. And when they say that, I always want to bring the illustration to them in Surah chapter 4, verse 35, where if a husband suspects his wife of infidelity, that one of the ways of disciplining her, the Quran says that you, your wife. So therefore, when they talk to me about equality of men and women, they talk about women's rights, I want to point out to them what their own holy book teaches, that it's permissible for a man to beat his wife because he suspects her of committing adultery. So where are the rights of women in a situation like this when the Quran itself gives permission for the husband to do that to his wife? To me, it's a no-brainer. There are no rights for women when the man is given the right to strike his wife physically. How can you say that men and women are equal when the Quran teaches otherwise? And so we have this situation when many, many Muslim activists rise up like Wafa and speak out against their own religion. I applaud them for their courage. There are many, many Muslims who have spoken out in the documentary Honor Diaries, and I applaud them for their courage. But yet, I have a problem when they talk about Islam. I want to ask them, how is it that Islam is helpful to women? How is it that Islam teaches that men and women are equal when you have a command in the Quran that a husband can touch his wife in this way and beat her because he suspects her of committing adultery? I have yet to hear a good answer to that particular situation. I'm willing to listen. I want to hear what my Muslim friends have to say. I have nothing against them. They are some of my best friends. But I think there is a real problem with the teaching of Islam when it comes to the rights of women. And this is just one example that I'd like to talk about. Well, we've heard Wafa Sultan talk about a God who hates. And what I want to do now is transition to a God who doesn't hate, but a God who loves. A few years ago, when I first began writing my blogs on the cross in the desert, I thought about what is the most important thing I can communicate to the Muslim people. I mean, I can talk about differences of teachings between the Quran and the Bible. I can point out some logical conceptions and contradictions here. But I begin to think, while all of that is profitable in some ways as far as dialogue and interaction, to me one of the most important things I can communicate to my Muslim friends beyond anything else is that Christianity is a love relationship with God. And the reason I say that is when you read the Quran and you get down to the nitty-gritty details, when the Quran talks about love in such a limited way, the God of the Quran and love, even if there are mentions of love by Allah, it is a love that has to be earned. It is not a gift like in Christianity. And there are passages that talk about earning salvation, good deeds versus bad deeds, weighing the scales. And if the Quran even mentions love, it is in the context of something that you earn, that you must demonstrate to Allah. Well, it's the exact opposite in Christianity. Christianity is a love relationship with God. And I was thinking about the book that Wafa Sultan wrote and her testimony about a God who hates. And I came across one of my old blogs, and I wanted to talk to you about that today in our closing minutes. In fact, I wanted to read this to you because I want you to hear my heart about this. Everyone is probably familiar with that little phrase in the Bible. Maybe many people don't know much about Christianity in the Bible, but they know this phrase, God is love, 1 John chapter 4, verse 16. Most people, let's flesh out what that means, God is love. This short little affirmation, tucked into the 16th verse of John's first epistle, sums up the nature of God. God is loving, compassionate, merciful, and forgiving. The God of the Bible pursues us with his irresistible love. The length, width, height, and depth of his love can never be measured. It is unfathomable. Scripture declares that, quote, God demonstrated his love toward us and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Romans chapter 5, verse 8. God put his love on display 2,000 years ago. His love was not mere words or sentimental feelings, but an open display on a wooden cross where he gave his life so that you and me might live. Well, the Bible is filled with pictures of God's irresistible love, the tender care of a shepherd for his sheep. And when he loses one, he searches everywhere until he finds the lost sheep, and then he rejoices. The picture of a merciful father who pursues his wayward prodigal son, and when he finally finds him, he runs to him and throws his arms of love around his son in forgiveness. These are pictures and illustrations wonderfully painted in the teachings of Scripture. Jesus, the master storyteller, loved to paint pictures of God's love in his teachings. He was grieved by the heavy burdens of the law put on the Jewish people by the religious scribes and Pharisees. They painted the picture of a stern and demanding God, expecting his people to live up to an endless list of standards. Instead of putting more religious demands on people, Jesus held out his arms of compassion, inviting sinners to himself, saying, "Come to me, you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Are you resting and trusting in the perfect righteousness of God as a gift? Or are you trapped on a performance treadmill trying to earn the love and grace of God? On the day of judgment, God will not ask how many times that you prayed or fasted. Instead, he will ask, "What did you do with my son?" Christianity is a love relationship with God. It is based on an invitation to rest in the love and forgiveness of Jesus. Religion or relationship? Which will you choose? I remember just a few weeks ago talking to my Muslim friend, Manny, who's from Morocco. She works in the hospital where I work, and she works in the food service department. And this was during Ramadan, and I went up to Manny one day. I said, "I have to commend you, Manny, how faithful you must be to be able to fast during Ramadan, this holy month for Muslims, and yet you work in food service. I'm sure you are tempted and overwhelmed. How do you do this?" And she says, "Well, I know I have to do this. It's important." And, you know, I commend her for her resistance while she's working in food service during Ramadan. But notice what she says, "I have to do this." You see, most Muslims are under obligation and religion. I must perform fasting. I must do good deeds. I must. Why? Because their God is a God of demand, and you must meet these requirements. I will not love you. You see, most Muslims know that on the day of judgment, their good works must outweigh their bad. But in Christianity, God says very simply, for by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourself. It is the gift of God, lest anyone boast. Christianity is a love relationship. Salvation is given freely as a gift because none of our good works can ever pay the debt of sin. We have broken his holy law. We stand guilty before a holy God. Instead of demanding more of our performance, he holds out his arms of love, knowing we're incapable of doing that, and says, come to me. You that are weary and heavy laden, I will give you rest. I want you to ask yourself that question. When you stand before a holy God, on what basis will you enter into heaven? If your answer is my good works, you will fail. But if your answer is I have trusted in the righteousness of Christ, then that's the right answer. I hope that this program today will drive you into a deeper walk with Christ to help to know his grace in a more tangible and beautiful way. I want to thank my guest Teresa for coming on and sharing about the prayer vigil in her ministry. I want to thank you, most importantly, for spending your busy time listening to The Cross in the Desert. It is my pleasure to do this program for you. This coming Thursday, Pastor Donald Farid from Persian Ministry will be my guest. He's going to talk about his ministry to the Iranian people. I look forward to that. God bless you. Have yourself an incredible week, and I will see you on the next Cross in the Desert. Goodbye, and God bless you.
Healing rain is coming down, it's coming nearer to this old town, rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy, it won't be long.